I thought our hymns were especially appropriate this morning as they spoke to the sovereignty of our God in the midst of times of despair, times of great distress, times of confusion and perplexity, such times as we've experienced this past week in our country. Think of the one that we sang, "This is my Father's world," the last stanza there. "Oh, let me ne'er forget that though the wrong seems oft so strong," isn't that so true? That the wrong around us seems so abundant and so uncontained and unrestrained. But though the wrong seems oft so strong, God is the ruler yet. We never can forget the sovereign rule of our God. "This is my Father's world. Why should my heart be sad?" And we are sad, and we do grieve with those who grieve this past week. But we also want to have our heart focused on the fact that the Lord is King, that the heavens ring, God reigns, let earth be glad. Very appropriate, the songs, and there were similar refrains in many of the other choruses. It's been a week of disasters for our nation. We can make a distinction, and we need to make a distinction, between the wicked type of atrocities that were inflicted by the evil Boston Marathon bombers. Make a distinction between those atrocities and the unexplained tragedy of the industrial accident that leveled that area surrounding the fertilizer plant in Texas. One is an atrocity. One is intentionally committed by the evil of men. The other is a tragedy. But in both cases, there were significant injuries. There was significant loss of life. There is still mourning and sadness. There is still difficulty in coping emotionally and physically and in every way. What a sad week for our country. Our heart goes out to those who have been directly impacted, to those who lost loved ones, to those who are seeking to recover physically. I mean, those images are burned, I'm sure, in all of our minds in the media age in which we live. Image of an 8-year-old boy, how someone could place a knapsack with a bomb in front of an 8-year-old boy who lost his life, his sister who lost her limb, his mother who has significant brain injuries, how that family, as they wait for their father to have this victorious celebration and cross the finish line there at the Boston Marathon, how those hopes and dreams are blown up in this one moment of time. So our heart goes out to those, but we must ask the question that everyone asks in times like this. Is God still in control? When you look at the tumultuous, the troubling times like these, do we really have the conviction in our heart that God is really in control? You know, you need that conviction planted and nurtured and sustained before these times of crisis hit. Because in the midst of all of that, that's not the time when you can easily walk up to someone and put your arm around their shoulders and start to instruct them from the Word of God as to what God says in a theological sense. You need to have those convictions deeply rooted so that they're expressed and they sustain you during times like that. Our passage today in the book of Isaiah, it predicts unparalleled times of destruction and devastation, not just for King Ahaz and his family, but for the whole nation of Judah, for God's people. Now, there's a direct connection in our passage to God bringing about all of this devastation on account of sin, as a judgment for sin. And I want to be very careful that I'm not making any parallel type of reference that I know the reason why we saw such devastation this past week. I don't know. And there are many causes for devastation. But the connection that I want to make is that in either event, the Lord is in control and the Lord is sovereign and He directs the courses of all nations. He directs the courses of individuals, even terrorists, even evil men that would make decisions like this. The Lord is in control, and that's the point of, of connections. There's multiple reasons why calamity befalls us in this sinful world. Some of it is tied to judgment. Some of it is for pruning purposes, that the Lord wants to refine us and purify us, and He wants to make us a stronger people. Some of it is simply for His glory, because in all events, God is working to bring about that which is going to ultimately glorify Him in ways that we don't understand and that we cannot see. But the connection I want you to see is that God is in control. And even in the midst of however difficult the circumstances get, God still makes provision for His people. Not that none of His people were killed in the Texas incident. I don't know. You know, there could surely be many that were trusting in the Lord. He might deliver us through a tragedy. He might deliver us from a tragedy, but He's still sufficient in terms of how He makes provision for us. So we have to hold on to that truth of the sovereignty of God over all our external circumstances. Turn to the book of Habakkuk. And we've looked there before, but Habakkuk chapter 1 is just so important because it talks about the Chaldeans and how the Lord raised up a wicked nation, like the Assyrians, how He raised up a wicked nation to punish Judah. And this is very parallel to what our passage speaks of, but I think it balances nicely both sides of the equation of God's sovereignty and His control and man's responsibility, that the wicked are still held morally accountable, and that they will pay, and that there will be an accounting before God for their actions, even though God had used them in this instance to be a tool of discipline for His people. So Habakkuk cries out in chapter 1, "How long, O Lord, will I call for help and you will not hear? I cry out to you, there's violence, yet you don't seem to save." And he goes on, he says, there's destruction, there's violence all around me. Verse 5, he says, "Look among the nations, observe, be astonished, wonder, because I am doing something in your days you would not believe if you were told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans." Well, what kind of character do the Chaldeans have? You know, compared to whom God is judging. Well, the Chaldeans, they're that fierce and impetuous people who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places which are not theirs. They're dreaded. They're feared. Their justice and authority originate with themselves. They don't recognize themselves as a servant of God and of someone who's carrying out His program of justice. They don't have any concept of that at all. They view themselves as autonomous and as independent agents in what they're doing. And it describes their military might, and it describes how they humiliate their captives. But it says in verse 11, look at verse 11. It says, "Then they will sweep through like the wind and pass on, but they will be held guilty, they whose strength is their God." There is accountability that God is going to exact from them, despite the fact that in this instance, God is in control and God has chosen to use the Chaldeans, just as we see back in Isaiah chapter 7, that God is going to use the Assyrians to judge His people, Judah, back here. "The hand of the Lord, as shocking as it may be, as surprising as it may be to us, the hand of the Lord uses wicked instruments for judgment to bring about almost total desolation." There's still a little ray of hope in our passage. We'll see it. It's not much. There's not much hope in this passage. There's a little remnant that's left in the land that God sustains with curds and with honey. It's such a small remnant. But the thrust of the passage is not in any positive vein. The thrust of the passage is on the complete desolation and wilderness and destruction that God brings about because of sin, and that God is the direct administrator of the judgment that He is bringing about. So He gives a summary statement in verse 17 of Isaiah chapter 7. The structure of the passage is very simple. He gives a nice summary statement of what He's trying to proclaim to King Ahaz, and then He elaborates upon it. He gives a number of enhancements to explain His message by way of different images as He goes through in the remainder of the chapter. And so these amplifications, as they are introduced by the same introductory phrase of "in that day." And so when you see in verse 18, it says, "In that day, what's the Lord going to do?" And it goes to verse 20, it says, "In that day." And verse 21, "Now in that day." And you go to verse 23, it'll come about in that day. So it has these the structure based around that introductory formula that introduces these four images. So if you wanted to outline this passage, after you get that summary statement in verse 17, you have, first of all, the image of flies and bees in verses 18 and 19. And then, secondly, in verse 20, you have the image of that hired razor with the Lord himself doing the shaving with this hired razor. And then, number three, in verses 21 to 22, you have the image of curds and honey, the impoverished diet. And then finally, in verses 23 to 25, the image of briars and thorns. What does the land look like? It doesn't look prosperous. It doesn't look productive. It's not a place where you would like to inhabit. It's a land characterized by briars and thorns. So he's very graphically given us these four different types of images to lead us to amplify his summary statement there in verse 17. So verse 17 says, "The Lord will bring on you, on your people and on your father's house, such days as have never come since the day that Ephraim separated from Judah." And you have to pause at that point, because he's built that up. You know, it doesn't even, you don't even know exactly what he's referring to. And then he sticks in that, by way of climax, by way of emphasis, he says, "the king of Assyria." That should strike horror, that should strike terror in your heart, as he points to, in a crescendo kind of fashion, what he's building up to say that's whom the Lord is going to bring upon you for judgment, is this king of Assyria. In our syntax, it doesn't really read right in the English. You say, well, how is that sort of stuck in there after Ephraim separated from Judah? What is the? It just stands by itself as something that's put in Hebrew at the end there by way of emphasis, to say, this is what the Lord is going to bring about. The Lord will bring on you, forget all the rest, is like a parenthesis. The Lord will bring on you the king of Assyria. That's who the Lord is bringing on you. So you have to read that a little bit differently than I think it reads in our English. So this summary statement points to unparalleled bad times that are coming for Ahaz and for Judah. First of all, there's the shocking administrator of this judgment. Who is it that's going to oversee this judgment? Who's initiating it? Who's bringing it about? Who is in control of this judgment? And it's a shocking message to Ahaz. It's a shocking message to the people of Judah, who felt that they were somehow in a protected status, that they somehow, because they were part of the covenant people, that they were sort of untouchables in some sense. Yes, they realized the pressure that they were under in this alliance between Syria and Israel, but they had chosen their route of escape. They had chosen, King Ahaz had made his decision to align himself with the king of Assyria, to go there for help. He certainly didn't have any sense that he was going to, in doing this, that he would be completely forsaken by God. He didn't even care that much about Jehovah God. He was an apostate in terms of having turned his faith away from God to put his faith in the king of Assyria. But still, it's shocking when you read here that it's the Lord himself that will personally bring about this judgment upon the people. And this emphasis that the Lord will bring it about, it's stressed three times in this text here, in this last half of Isaiah chapter 7. Because in verse 18 it says, "The Lord will whistle." Who's the one that's going to summon these enemies? The Lord himself is the one who's going to whistle. Who's going to shave with that hired razor? Verse 20, it says the Lord's the one. Yes, he's going to use the Assyrians. The Assyrians are just a weapon in his hand. They're just an instrument. They're just a razor in his hand. The Lord himself, in verse 20, is the one who's going to do the shaving of his people and of his land. It's a shocking statement to say that the Lord is behind this, in control of this, initiating this, administering this type of judgment. So the Lord here is working against his own people and bringing them low. What that means is there's no escaping this judgment. There's no one else that you can turn to who's more powerful, who somehow can give you deliverance, who can make a way of escape for you. There is no way that you're going to be able to get out from under the hand of the Lord, because the Lord himself, who sees all, who knows all, who's all powerful, the Lord himself is the one who's bringing it about. And then, shocking as well, are the targets of this judgment. Isaiah spells them out very clearly. He says, it's going to be directed against you personally, Ahaz. Ahaz, you had your opportunity. God came to you despite your wickedness and said you could ask for a sign, whatever it might be, as high as the heavens above, as low as Sheol beneath. And you rejected God. God then rejected you and turned and offered that sign of Emmanuel, of God with us. That's the only provision for salvation. That Messiah is the only refuge that we can turn to. But you have rejected that path. God has turned away from you. And now the targets of judgment. You know, God, with his drone that he's able to dial in and he's able to focus and direct, he doesn't make any mistakes. There's no collateral damage, in a sense, with God. It's not some messy operation that God administers here. His drone strikes right at the heart of where he wants to target. And he says, that target is you, King Ahaz. It's your family. It's your people, the nation of Judah. And that's whom God is going to go after here. What a terrifying thing to listen to from Isaiah. And then the extent of judgment, thirdly, is shocking as well. He says, God's going to bring about unparalleled bad times. You know, it's one thing to have bad times. It's another thing to have really bad times. But it's another thing to have unparalleled, never before seen or experienced bad times. And that's what Isaiah says is going to happen. He says, you can go back and you can think back in the history of the nation Israel to what was a watermark event, something that was epic in our history. And that is the splitting apart, the dividing of our nation into the 10 northern tribes and the 2 southern tribes. As you had the split with Jeroboam and Rehoboam there, and what happened after the days of Solomon. What a tragic thing for the people of God to be so separated. And what an awful time that was. But this time, it harkens back to that. And he's pointing to, as he talks about this day that is coming, and it's the same terminology that he uses when he speaks of the day of the Lord throughout the book of Isaiah, that day of judgment. And here it's going to have a near-term focus, but it also extends on and even foreshadows what will happen in the days of the Great Tribulation period before the coming again of the Messiah. The nation is never again going to be like it has been up to this point in time. That great commentator, E.J. Young, here's what he writes about the significance of this period in Israel's history, these unparalleled bad times. E.J. Young says, with the coming of the Assyrian king, an entire new order of things is introduced. With Tiglath-Pileser III, the destruction of the theocracy began, and a whole new period was introduced. What set in motion the train of events leading up to the exile and the abolishing of the theocracy was the coming of this particular Assyrian king. From this time on, nothing would be as it has been before. The end of the theocracy was now in sight. This is how significant Ahaz's unbelief was. By his refusing to obey the Lord, Ahaz was responsible for the introduction of this whole new order of things. You can track from now on, Israel will be under oppression by a succession of foreign powers up till the time when they're destroyed in AD 70 under the hands of the Romans. You're going to have, after the nation of Assyria comes in, and they're just stopped short of Jerusalem, of taking Jerusalem, and then you have the Babylonians under Sennacherib come in, and the Babylonians rise to power, and the Babylonians take people away into captivity. And then you have the oppression under the Medes and the Persians. You have the oppression under the Greeks, and you have the Greeks ravaging the land. Then you have the Roman Empire. One after another, these foreign, pagan, uncircumcised nations are going to come in and are going to have dominion over the land that should have been God's theocracy as that bright and shining star that would bring the light of God's word and the law of God's word to the world. And yet that will not happen until the Messiah comes in his kingdom. And so all of that's wrapped up in here, this is a pivotal, epic point in Israel's history as Ahaz takes them down this path of changing their allegiance in almost a permanent sense, changing their allegiance away from the covenant-keeping God and saying, we're going to trust in the arm of flesh and we're going to trust in Assyria. So it's shocking to see that God is the one administering judgment. It's shocking to see the targets of judgment. It's shocking to see the extent of judgment. It's unparalleled. And then it's shocking and terrifying and horrifying to see the instrument of judgment that God is going to use. He sums it all up. Who is the Lord going to bring on you? The king of Assyria. Wait, says Ahaz. I've paid my dues. I've bribed the king of Assyria with all types of silver and gold. He's on my side. He's the one that's going to come in and rescue me. In fact, didn't you just tell me that the nation Judah is going to be rescued from this alliance of Syria and of Israel? Yeah, that's a short-term deliverance. A short-term deliverance is no guarantee of ultimate long-term deliverance. You know, we need to be careful of that too in our lives. We can't look at some short-term experience and say, well, because of that, now I have security in my life and everything's going to be fine. We have to continue our path of persevering in faith and obedience. We can't just rely on some past experience. Ahaz is maybe thinking, oh, I'm getting off here. I had this promising word that the alliance between Syria and Israel was going to fail. And he says, well, I've hired King Ahaz to deliver me. And God says, oh, you spent the money, but I hired King Ahaz, and he is my razor that's going to come against you. So it's shocking for Ahaz to hear whom God has chosen to use as this instrument of judgment. The people that are so wicked, that are so cruel, that are so ungodly, and yet how ungodly is King Ahaz and the apostate nation and the hypocrites and the self-righteous ones in the nation of Israel. Whatever a man puts his trust in apart from God, the tables will be turned by God. That thing will end up devouring you. That's the thing about sin. Sin seems so pleasant. It seems like, oh, I want those pleasures of sin. And yet that same sin has a devouring effect when it's turned and it's unleashed in its consequences against us. Think of what God says about sexual immorality and sexual sins. He says, all sins are heinous in God's sight because of His holiness. And yet there's something about sexual sin, He says, that it destroys the body. It comes in there in a ravaging sense, in a destructive sense, and it turns itself on you and it destroys you in a way that you can't recover from, and has consequences that are ongoing. And so here we see that King Ahaz is confronted with how bad things are going to be. And then we see these four amplification statements with these graphical images as he uses the structure of it's going to come about in that day. And he goes on and he talks in more detail about what's going to happen. So verses 18 to 19, this first image, he uses the image of swarming insects, flies and bees, to speak of how this invasion is going to take place. There's going to be an invasion by enemy forces that are so pervasive, they're so cruel, again, you can't escape. There's no place you can hide. There's no place you can get away. It's just like these insects are all over you. And so he says, first of all, in verse 18, he speaks of these enemies, and geographically he points to those that are in the southwest, down in the southwest in terms of Egypt, and then those that are in the northeast in terms of Assyria. So he says, it will come about in that day. Again, it's the divine agency of the Lord Himself. The Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the remotest part of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. A lot of the imagery here harkens back to chapter 5, which we studied earlier. If you flip back to chapter 5, verse 26, this concept of the Lord whistling and of enemies immediately hearkening and coming and doing His bidding should not be foreign to us. Because this whole context from Isaiah 5 of the parable of the vineyard that God had planted and yet had not developed in the path of righteousness and therefore was destined for judgment, it says in 5 verse 26 that God will lift up a standard to the distant nation. He'll whistle for it from the ends of the earth, and behold, it will come with speed, swiftly. So the imagery of whistling is one of getting attention, it's one of commanding obedience, and it's one of securing that obedience in a very swift sense. Now, I would love to demonstrate that for you, but I'm handicapped in one awful sense I never learned how to whistle. You know, that's very sad. As a guy, you know, you should be able to whistle. I never could whistle. Who's got a good whistle? If you want to call your dog, who's got a good whistle for me? Who's got a good whistle? I'd like to hear a whistle. That's a whistle! That's a... How about you, Justin? You got one? Dad didn't pass that along. That's pretty good. That's pretty good, Charlie. When you got that whistle, okay, that evokes a little bit of a response. Okay? If you're whistling for the dog should come. Okay? And God says, I am in control. These nations, they are my vassals in the sense that all I have to do is whistle. And that king of Assyria, from as far away as he is, will come. Or that nation of Egypt. Now, he's talking here about both Egypt and Assyria. He's lumping all the enemies of Israel together because he has that long-term focus that what I'm talking about in that day, that concept, like we said, goes all the way to the time of the Great Tribulation period and all those nations. So he's dealing with all the nations. Then he's going to get more specific and he's going to target in on the near term and what's going to happen with Assyria especially. But in these two images, he picks flies to represent Egypt because that's a nation around the Nile River there with all the tributaries pouring into the Nile River. And when it floods every year and then the waters recede, you have all that marshy land, which lends itself to the mosquitoes and the flies, and there are just swarms of them, apparently, that were common in that part of the geography. And so it was well known that, yeah, there's lots of flies, and they're a nuisance, and they're annoying, and they're persistent, and you can't get rid of them, and you swat them on one side of your face, and they're on the other side of your face. And, you know how that is. If you go to some beach expecting to have a nice time of relaxation, and you happen to be on a beach that's just beset with those big black flies, those biting flies, you think, why did I take off work? Why did I pay to come to this place, you know? And I remember once we were at Chincoteague, and I don't know what time of year it was, but boy, those flies at Chincoteague were just, I don't have a whole lot of tolerance in terms of being an outdoors guy. It doesn't take much in the way of insects to drive me off and say, you know, I'd rather read my book in the screened-in porch or the air conditioning. You know? Well, this, he picks this imagery here, and he says these flies are going to be all over you. I mean, they're just persistent. They're pervading. You can't get away from them. And then he picks, for the imagery for Assyria, he picks that of the bee because it's a picture of cruelty, of danger, of you know, persistent, relentless pursuit of going after you, being chased. Have any of you been chased by bees where you were just terrified? You're just, can you get away? You know, those bees will get you. You just can't get away. I remember once we were on vacation with my sister, and they had this nice little dog, and we were at a lake, and the dog's tied up to a tree down by the lake, and I'm in the kitchen looking down there, and my brother-in-law was his dog, Burgess was his dog, and he comes in, all of a sudden Burgess is cursing, he's ranting, why isn't anybody saving the dog? And I look down there, and here the dog had stirred up this bee's nest, and these bees are, this poor dog is tied up to the street. Burgess grabs the knife in the kitchen there, and he tears down there, and he slashes the rope, and he grabs the dog, and he jumps in, plunges into the lake, and immerses himself. And then he comes, the dog is shaking, the dog is quivering. We drive to the emergency room, wherever it is, you know, to try and take care of the little puppy. It was all those bees. If you stir up a hornet's nest, you get a cluster of bees that are around you. It's pretty savage, and it's pretty terrifying thing. So he says that's the imagery of the invasion that's going to take place. These are the enemies that God is going to summon. He's going to summon flies from Egypt and bees from Assyria. And these enemies, verse 19, they're going to come and they're going to settle down in all places in the land. There's no place that you can hide. You might think that there are caves and there are crevices in the rocks and there are places where you can go where you will be safe. Well, you'll go there, and you'll find that ahead of you, the flies and the bees are already there waiting for you. You cannot escape the judgment that God is bringing here. They'll come, they'll settle on the steep ravines. You know, places that are hard to climb to, and you struggle to get up there. It's not hard for the flies and bees to get there. No problem. They're there, you know. The ledges of the cliffs, and another place that's precarious, that's difficult to get to, that you might think offers some protection. It doesn't offer any protection against enemies that are flies and bees. On all the thorn bushes and on all the watering places, whether the place is accessible or inaccessible, whether the place is vital for survival, like a watering hole, or someplace, a thorn bush, that's the last place in the world you'd want to be. But whatever it is, you'll find that the flies and the bees will pursue you there. And this invasion, it's a pervasive, it's a cruel invasion, and again, it's directed by the hand of the Lord. So those images of flies and bees should stick with us as we think of the judgment that God is going to bring. And then, secondly, in verse 20, he puts the emphasis on the instrument of God's judgment, whom God is going to use to humiliate the nation of Judah. And that image is one of a hired razor. He's going to use cruel Assyria under the sovereign direction of the Lord. It says, in that day, again, using that same introductory formula, the Lord will shave with a razor. He's the one administering the judgment. And it's going to be horrible when you think of the identification of this adversary, because whom the Lord hired, whom he summoned like with the whistle, who he hired to be this razor, is one that comes from the regions beyond the Euphrates. Now he's focusing in specifically on the near-term judgment that's going to take place under Tiglath-Pileser. He says it's going to be that king of Assyria, that same king of Assyria in whom you placed your trust, in whom you thought that you could get some type of a peace treaty with that would be to your benefit. Not only is he not to your benefit, he's going to prove to be your undoing. He's going to prove to be the one that comes up against you. So he speaks very specifically and graphically of the humiliation that's going to be inflicted by the enemy. And it's almost like you take a prisoner and you strip this prisoner naked, and then you shave this prisoner from head to foot in a way that's completely disgraceful and shameful and humiliating and debasing. That's the type of imagery that he gives here that he's going to use with this razor of the king of Assyria. So he says there's going to be the shaving of the head. Now, the shaving of the head often speaks of mourning over loss of life, over devastation. And it's something where, again, your pride, part of your pride and your glory is your hair. And something, if you want to humble yourself before God, if you want to show that you're in a state of mourning, you shave your head. Well, here your head will be shaved for you, and you will be in a position of sadness and humiliation and mourning as your head is shaved. And then he says, and the hair of the legs. And this is, I think, the commentators have said, this is a euphemism for your private parts, really. Not just, you know, all of your legs, but it's talking about that hidden hair. What is visible and normally visible, that's going to be shaved off. And what is invisible, you'll be humiliated ultimately in that area as well. So he goes on and he says, there will be that shaving of the hair of the legs. You'll be completely disgraced. And then there will be the shaving of the beard. It will also remove the beard. The beard is what marks you as a man of maturity, as a man who should be respected. It's a mark of your wisdom and your experience and how you should be looked at and with honor. But when that beard is shaved off, you know, in all of these instances, you're made to look like some immature, foolish youngster. Is how you're made to appear. You look ridiculous. You look silly. You're made fun of in a mocking type of a fashion. You think of that incident in 2 Samuel chapter 10 where David's servants, turn there, 2 Samuel chapter 10, and we'll just look at the disgrace that came about upon David's servants and how he dealt with that in 2 Samuel chapter 10. It happened afterwards, it says, that the king of the Ammonites had died, and Hanun, H-A-N-U-N, Hanun his son became king in his place. So here's David's thought process. He has this political idea to try to strike some type of peace treaty with this new king. He says, I'll show kindness to Hanun, the son of Naash, just as his father showed kindness to me. So he sent some of his servants to console him concerning his father. But when David's servants came to the land of the Ammonites, the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun, their lord, do you think that David's honoring your father because he has sent counselors to you, consolers to you? Has David not sent his servants to you in order to search the city, to spy it out and overthrow it? So they accuse David of wrong motives here, of really wanting to conspire against them. And so they stirred up this new king and said, you can't trust David's initiative here. And so in verse 4, we see what Hanan did. He took David's servants. He shaved off half of their beards. You know, if it's humiliating and you look silly and ridiculous to have your beard shaved off, how silly do you look when half of your beard is shaved off? How do you correct that without just shaving off the whole beard and starting from scratch? I mean, you look completely ridiculous. And so they shaved off half their beards. They cut off their garments in the middle as far as their hips. Okay, so they stripped them down and they just completely embarrassed them. And then they sent them away. And when they told it to David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly humiliated. And the king said, stay at Jericho until your beards grow, and then return. This was just the worst imaginable thing that could happen to these proud, valiant soldiers and emissaries and servants of the King David. And yet, this is what's going to take place throughout the whole land of Judah. This razor that the Lord is going to wield in terms of the king of Assyria is going to, in a cruel and humiliating fashion, treat the entire nation in this way. And they will end up looking that silly and that ridiculous and that humiliated and disgraced. Verses 21 to 22 back in Isaiah chapter 7. We're left with a land where there's just an impoverished diet. All you have are curds and honey to eat. It'll come about in that day that a man may keep alive a heifer and a pair of sheep. You know, to us city dwellers, you know, that might sound like, oh, wow, man, they got a cow and two sheep. That sounds like, but for them, you know, they were used to large flocks and large herds. This is a subsistence type of a diet is what is portrayed here. This isn't a picture of prosperity. You know, we think of the land, the promised land, it flows with milk and honey. Well, it flows with milk and honey, and that's just the immediate provision in that context until you're able to come in and dwell and cultivate the land and raise up crops like wheat and rye and barley so that you have something substantial to eat, and you're able to have your flocks pasture there so that you have herds of animals so that you can have the choicest meats and you can slaughter the animals and you can enjoy these types of meals. What is really pictured with this milk and honey, or this curds, more like a yogurt type of consistency of the milk as it's coagulated here. So this curds and honey, it's a diet of poverty. It's where the land has not been cultivated and inhabited in a sense where you've got a good, solid economy. All that you have is what migratory people would have who travel from one point to another and just sort of have to live off of the rudimentary nature of the land, of whatever they can extract. You get enough, yet here's the only glimmer of hope I find is for the remnant that's left in the land. At least they don't die of famine. At least God provides for them a diet of curds and of honey. God is able to sustain them even in the most difficult times. God is still able to make provision, but we don't want to misunderstand this provision as some spectacular, prosperous thing. This is a picture of impoverishment. This is a picture of a land that's desolated, that's a wilderness existence where you're moving from place to place and you don't have that settled roots down where you're cultivating your economy. And so this is a sad thing here to see this diet, and yet it's that glimmer of hope that yet God still has that remnant theology that goes throughout the book of Isaiah, that God still keeps and maintains his people in that sense. So he still sustains them in the most difficult of times. And then he finishes up in verses 23 to 25 with that threefold repetition. I'm sure you picked up the emphasis as I read it earlier. Briars and thorns. Briars and thorns. Briars and thorns. That is what characterizes the land now. The land that should have been so prosperous now is just completely overgrown. You think of the contrast between the Garden of Eden and how God put man in the Garden of Eden to till it and to cultivate it and to produce all types of trees that were good to eat and vines that would have fruit that was good to eat. And man, even after the fall, man, God wanted man to have dominion in a sense. Now you're going to have to work hard, though, because after the fall, the environment's going to fight against you. The environment's not going to help you anymore. In the Garden of Eden, work was such a productive, positive thing because you had the environment cooperating with you. Now we go to work, And we should expect that we're faced with briars and thorns. Briars and thorns are part of the sinful equation of the world in which we live. You are some type of naive person, especially young folks. If you grow up thinking, I'm going to have some type of work experience, and it's going to be like the Garden of Eden, and I'm going to unleash my creative potential that God has given me, and I'm going to find myself in a situation where every day I'm fulfilled to the utmost, and work is such a fantastic, enjoyable, productive thing. That has not been my experience. That will not be your experience. You will be naive if you enter into work not realizing that it no longer cooperates with you, but it fights against you in terms of briars and thorns because of the impact of sin on our fallen culture and our fallen world. And here, you have that impact magnified so that instead of man trying to struggle to have dominion over the earth, the earth has dominion here with its briars and thorns, and man has all he can do to subsist, to just exist, to try to fight amongst these briars and thorns, to carve out just a place where he can dwell in safety. And so it's a very difficult picture that's given here. First of all, verses 23 to 25, you see the worthless wilderness that's pictured here. The whole land has been devalued. It says it will come about in that day that every place where there used to be 1,000 vines valued at 1,000 shekels of silver, now there's no value. The value has been completely eliminated. The land has been devalued to the point where you have worthless briars and thorns characterizing your land. You no longer have these choice vines. Remember, it harkens back to Isaiah 5, where God says, I didn't just plant vines, I planted choice vines. I cultivated them with the best fertilizer. I took care of them with the best husbandry and the best care that you could possibly imagine, and expected that these would be valuable vines that would produce luscious grapes that are good. And yet, remember that stinking rotten fruit that we saw from Isaiah chapter 5. Well, here you see the land is completely devalued. Then secondly, verse 24, people will come there with bows and arrows because all the land will be briars and thorns. Now it's dangerous. Instead of it being a protected haven, of it being this nice refuge where you can just stroll through the meadows and you can just enjoy the pastoral setting, instead of that type of a sensation, you better, when you step outside of your cave or your get out from under your rock or wherever it is that you're sleeping, when you go out there, you better take your bows and your arrows with you, because all you're going to face are wild animals that are roaming around that will do you harm. So yes, you might use those bows and arrows. Maybe there's some aspect of hunting involved here, but I think the bigger picture is the threat of danger. That these wild animals are against you. They'll just as soon tear you apart and feed off of you as something else. You better have your bows and whatever your weaponry is, you better bring that with you to protect yourself, because you are in a position of danger. In this land, you are not the king where everybody respects you. You are the lowest thing on the feeding, you know, strata there. And they'll be out for you. So it's a dangerous, very dangerous type of a setting. And then thirdly, verse 25, it's a picture of desolation. Just how the wasteland here, it's not suitable even for cultivation. He says, as for all the hills, which used to be, the word here is it used to be hoed with the hoe. You had that mattock. You had that digging instrument where you would on the hill, you would be able to, in a terracing effect, you would be able to carve out some fertile areas that you would be able to, in terms of gardens, you would be able to cultivate. You'd be able to yield the produce and you'd harvest something good. Well, now that area that you used to hoe with the hoe, you used to cultivate it, you won't even go there for fear of briars and thorns. All the place is good for, this wasteland, this desolate wasteland, all that it's good for, it says, is for pasturing oxen and for sheep to trample. These are wild animals. These aren't your nice pets. It's just picturing wild animals that are on the loose that can somehow get around in this environment that is so antagonistic to human habitation. Well, these animals can exist there, and they can, maybe you'll get some benefit from these animals. But in terms of how things used to be, this is what lies ahead in the immediate future and is going to work itself out down through the days of Tiglath-Pileser and then through Egypt getting involved and Egypt coming up and there being some some warfare between Egypt and Assyria, and then the Babylonians get involved with Sennacherib, and then again these successive nations that come in that we spoke of, right down until the days when the nation is trampled over by Rome in AD 70. It says, you're going to see this type of devastation from time to time where things get this bad, and of course it looks forward to the Great Tribulation period. So the choice that is placed before King Ahaz is the choice that's placed before each of us. We are offered the promise of turning and putting our hopes in Emmanuel, in God with us. What a tremendous, gracious provision that God makes and that God still offers, but King Ahaz turned his back on that. King Ahaz says, I want Tiglath-Pileser. And God says, you will have Tiglath-Pileser. And that's the picture that we see here in sad state of affairs in this section in the book of Isaiah. But we don't want to forget the connection to today, that God is in control of all this. God is the one that orchestrated this, and we know that it brings comfort to us to know that however bad the events are, even of this past week, God is still the one that's in control, and He's still the one that offers grace and mercy and comfort and offers protection and refuge to us as we turn to Him. But we must make sure that we don't turn to the arm of the flesh, that we don't try to reason things out with our own understanding, because these things, it's so difficult for man to stomach that in our natural reason. You mean you want me to believe? You're telling me that God, there's a good God, and yet somehow that 8-year-old boy and his family died this past week. I don't think God exists. I don't think there's a good God that's around. We have to hold on to the sovereignty of God and His goodness at work in all that He's doing as we think through this context. Let's pray.